As I came down the Highgate Hill, the Highgate Hill, the Highgate Hill, as I came down the Highgate Hill, I met the sun's bravado, and saw below me, fold on fold, grey to pearl and pearl to gold, this London like a land of old, the land of El Dorado. Henry Howarth, Bashford's Romances.
So as usual, I've opened the front door and grabbed the first two likely-looking Londoners who happen to be out there.
It does seem that everyone's got a story to tell.
I think screaming does help as well.
Ooh, yes, the Horniman Walrus.
They dug out bodies in 1887, 1873.
What did he look like when he came out the other end of that?
Knackered.
Got Sarah Palin coming. How do you feel about that?
A little bit pathetic.
So we're in the parlour of Dr. Johnson's house.
One sees a story that is both of protests and of coming together.
So they're banning people from bringing food to homeless.
Yeah, they're banning soup runs.
You know, we weren't buckled by the tailors.
A word in your eye, don't worry or push. A step in the gate is worth two in the bush.
Which area of ridiculousness do we start on with that story? Why would you give a medal to a pigeon?
Listen, you're all idiots. You don't understand culture or anything.
No running, no throwing. This is pretty serious stuff.
You engage with other people, you link across to other people.
It's just huge. It's gigantic.
How many times have you done this so far?
That depends.
What do you think of that approach?
I think that's terrible.
London life is a really rich experience, and there's a lot that's good about living
here. Boris Johnson.
He weighs as much as 40 school children.
What a peculiar conversation. Hello, it's Friday, September the 21st, 2012. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud, a podcast of news, views, and curiosities from London, UK. You can download the show free on iTunes, hook up on Facebook at Londonist Out Loud, or tweet me at Londonist Sound. Well, we're in Bermondsey Street near London Bridge today. It's a very attractive sort of morning, just easing into autumn. With me here are Sian Mead. She's the founding editor of Domestic Sluttery, a UK-based blog for women who have better things to do, discovering the best in design, fashion, food, and travel. Also with us is Lara Haley, who made a patchwork quilt based on the Peckham Peace Wall. And it's been on show at Southwark Cathedral, just around the corner from here, and this week moved to Peckham Multiplex. Hello, you both.
Hi, well, thank you.
Let's start with this Peckham Peace Wall, because I think that identifying what that is and what it looked like is probably key to understanding, Lara, your piece of work.
The Peckham Peace Wall was a thing which was made after the riots which happened in London last year, and it was set up by Peckham Sheds, which were a community theatre group, and they invited people to write down their thoughts about the riots, the sort of immediately after it had happened. 4,000 of these post-it notes were collected and put on the pound shop window. These have recently been turned into a permanent installation, which is now in Peckham Square. My quilt is a version of this, but obviously not with 4,000.
This might be a silly thing to do. Obviously, any Londoner who was in London this time last year will remember the riots extremely vividly. And, of course, they gained international attention as well. Some very striking images there. A quick recap, perhaps, for our listeners overseas as to what brought the riots about and how these messages came to be and what the sort of the mood was around that time, perhaps.
Well, the reason the riots started was because someone called Mark Duggan was shot in North London, in Tottenham. This seemed to get sort of completely out of control, and riots spread all across London, in fact, across Britain.
And, of course, we remember images of people jumping out of burning building. Doesn't it seem surreal to think that that was actually a thing?
The carpet shop in Croydon as well. You know, it's like family businesses were completely and utterly lost. You know, and I find it completely mad that it was, you know, the death of a man that started this, but yet the way people kind of fought back was by attacking their local shops. It makes no sense to me. It is nonsensical.
It didn't feel like London. It felt like a completely alien place.
A war zone or something. Yeah. Not that I've ever been to a war zone, but that is what Peckham looked like.
It had something very 28 days later about it.
Yeah.
But it was also scary to realise that, I mean, because I live in Greenwich, which isn't far from Peckham, and Greenwich was empty. Mm. And yet seeing Peckham on the news and seeing how terrifying it looked was actually really upsetting.
People were absolutely terrified. I actually I teach art and I started a new course yesterday, and two of my students were from Peckham, and I was explaining to them about this quilt that I'd made, and they were saying that, you know, they were terrified to go out on the streets in Peckham that night. It was just crazy.
So that's a bit of the background, and well, we've got some examples here in front of us, and the messages here on brightly coloured squares. We've got Peckham Love on one. Another one says, "There's no need for violence. Peckham is our hometown. Respect it because it's awesome." Says another. This is a great one. Gangster. It's only South Central LA in your head. that's brilliant. And I'm touching these, and I can feel that these are stitched and sewn. These are all done by hand.
Yeah, it's all hand stitching. Like I said, I started off making the quilt myself, so I thought of the idea and I thought, right, yeah, I'll start making this quilt. I've made quite a lot of quilts in my own practice, so it's not something sort of unusual. I stitched these six here, which was my kind of like sample. I realised how long it was going to take. So I thought, right, I need to get other people involved in doing this. So I asked students, friends, I work with community groups in Peckham. I kind of feel like working together with lots of people, it actually made it more of an authentic piece of artwork as well. Whereas if it had just been me sitting at home stitching these 400 squares, I'd have gone a bit crazy. But I think also it just brings the community together more, and it kind of shows how people come together in adversity.
There's some very pointed symbolism here, isn't it? And the idea of stitching things back together.
Yes. I think that was actually really something that was obvious in Peckham. You could see a lot of people doing that, and it's really nice to have that in something that's tactile but also permanent as well. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think a memory of the good stuff that came out of the riots, and I think there was good stuff, certainly with the kind of restoration and kind of how the communities pulled together afterwards. And I think the quilt is kind of a gorgeous way of doing that. So I do wonder if sometimes we lose a little bit of our community. We're always talking about London being this big cosmopolitan city. Actually, when you break it down, it's very small communities, and remembering that is a really nice thing to kind of keep hold of. And then you get really gorgeous projects like the quilt, and just a nice feeling about where you live, and I think that's a good thing.
I've certainly heard that sentiment expressed in regard to Peckham. Peckham seems to have something special going on there. I don't know if it's something that's growing or if it's always been there. I know there are two Peckhams as well. Some people regard there as being the sort of old school Peckham and the newfangled posh Peckham.
I think I've lived in Peckham for, I think, like 10 or 11 years now. And even I can feel the change over that time. There's loads of sort of new artistic ventures happening there. You've got the Bussey Building, which has, you know, all sorts of art exhibitions and arts cafe, club nights. You've got Peckham Space. You've got the Hannah Barry Gallery. There's very, very much a sort of, sort of community arts sort of feeling. But then at the same time, I do sense it is still segregated. Like, it seems to be very white, middle class, that whole art thing that's going on. But then you still have the kind of other people of Peckham. It's like if you go to like Frank's Cafe, which I'm sure you've both heard of, it is a great venue on top of the multi-story car park. You know, beautiful views, great bar, great vibe. But it's pretty much 99% white, which I find very peculiar in somewhere like Peckham, which isn't 99% white. I think it's a difficult thing, because I don't think it's that people are excluded, but I think it's just difficult to cross those kind of social cultural barriers. For instance, where the Bussey Building is and where the Hannah Barry Gallery is in this industrial park. And if you go to private views at the Hannah Barry Gallery, it's really interesting because you'll actually have sort of African church ceremonies going on at the same time that there are people going to these sort of private views. So people mix together in the space as well. Like, no one bothers about each other, but they're not actually doing the same thing.
And they don't come together either.
Yeah.
So two very conflicting communities, but not joined together in any way.
But not actually conflicting either.
No, absolutely. But I think last time I went to Frank's, it felt like it could have been in Shoreditch, and that made me feel quite sad actually. And I think it's lost something. So
we're in a venue here which is ideal for mixing people up, and I should say that differently, not for mixing people up, it comes out slightly dizzy, artists and makers and designers and writers and things here. Tell us a bit about this place that we're in down a side street in near London Bridge.
We're actually in the Woolyard building, which is where Domestic Sluttery offices are based with the creative charity Ideas Tap. They work with all sorts of kind of independent artists and designers, but also larger companies such as the National Theatre and the Old Vic, just to kind of bring a little bit of creativity. And the area is perfect for it. They're working with the Bermondsey Street Festival tomorrow. If you look around, like Alex Munro is down the road as a jewellery designer. There are so many kind of independent galleries around here, the White Cube's down the road. It's the perfect area to have something so creative kind of around here. And the restaurants on Bermondsey Street are also really lovely.
Okay, there's a few free meals lined up for Sian Meads there. Well, let's talk about your website, Domestic Sluttery, which offers a wide array of things to purchase.
It does look like it's a massive shopping website. And on the face of it, it could be called that, I guess. It's very much seeking out the best in design and interiors and in fashion as well. It launched 3.5 years ago when I think everyone was being a little bit careful, more careful with their money, and which then seemed strange to launch something that is about spending money, but actually it's more about not spending it on something frivolous, waiting and supporting an independent designer and finding a piece of art that you really love, and not just going to Primark and spending £8 on the dress, saving up for something that you absolutely love, and everything that you do spend your money on being precious and being special and meaning something to you. And now the site has kind of expanded, so we've taken that to look into more travel stuff. So instead of just booking a holiday in next to a beach, we'll write about some really unique places to go on holiday, whether it's a kind of clock tower on the Devon Estuary or a kind of a mental asylum in Edinburgh. We've written about both of those. The travel pieces are some of my favourites.
It seems to me that all of this hinges on not necessarily yours, I know there's lots of contributors to this site, but it seems to hinge on a particular person's view of what's fashionable and what isn't.
Because there are so many people on the site, we certainly follow trends, but we all argue, we all have different opinions, we all differ. I mean, sometimes someone will write about a pair of shoes and one of us will just kind of comment and just go, they're the most horrible things. And we argue and it's fun. So it wouldn't ever be just about one person's kind of trends and thoughts. If it was, it would just be me writing a lot about plates and that would get dull really quickly. But we also have areas that we love and really get excited about. Kat tends to write a lot about geeky stuff. I will do a weekly wallpaper feature. I'm besotted with wallpaper, absolutely obsessed with it. We've also got food writers. Kaylee does our gluten-free piece each week. We've got a male cocktail writer, so we do open up to a male audience as well.
Only on the cocktail front, though. That's the one limited area of the site that's going to...
No, we've had a lot of male guest writers as well. If you look at Jim Bobbard and Andrew Tanner, who's kind of a massive favourite, and the guys behind Mini Moderns as well. So, yeah, the designers are all very much male, so...
Does this sort of stuff appeal to you, Lara, or is this very, very alien to your way of thinking?
No, what I really liked about what you were saying was, encouraging people to save up and, like, spend money on something they really, really want rather than going to Primark and buying an £8 dress. I really hate that mentality. I'd much prefer to, buy, I don't know, 4 or 5 items of really nice clothing a year than, a dress every week, which I think is what people tend to do these days. I think that's really important.
So this is all about, this is a site all about sourcing interesting stuff, so people don't have to, because you're not going to find it in your average high street shop necessarily. It might be something that has come from an independent designer over here, and people wouldn't know about it otherwise.
Yeah, that's a big part of the site. And I mean, it started off as very much a kind of interiors blog, and also kind of crossed into food a lot as well. But we are now in a position where an independent designer can get in touch with us, and, you know, they may well still be at university, and just say, look, this is what I do, and we'll feature them. And that'll be the first piece of press they get, and we've opened them up to a large audience. And it's really nice to be able to do that instead of just saying that everything we get is from IKEA. It's nice to have a mix on the side. So.
I'm not going to ask about the name, because it seems to me quite obviously calculated to be just a little bit risque and provocative. I want to know, though, have you got yourself into hot water with anyone for that name?
We have. There are a couple of companies who didn't necessarily understand the name of the site when we launched. I think when you look at the site, it soon becomes quite obvious that we are kind of using Sluttery in a very tongue-in-cheek kind of way. It was a working title. The name of the blog was never meant to be Domestic Sluttery, but after 3 months of calling it that behind the scenes, it stuck, and it hasn't changed. Now, in hindsight, I think it was the best thing we could have done. But yeah, there are still some companies who shy away from us, and if that's the case, it wouldn't be necessarily a great mesh between the two companies anyway. So
I like that. Yeah, well, if they don't want us, we don't want them. Let's seamlessly move to something that I know is dear to your heart, Lara, cycling in London, particularly south of the river. And we've got news here of the cycle hire scheme being extended, but not in a direction that's necessarily useful to yourself.
No, this story is about it's being extended to the southwest. I actually looked at the map this morning.
To find out where the southwest is.
Yeah, exactly. I don't go there very often. And the cycle scheme seems to be all over London. Like, obviously, it's for all over the central part, the north part. Now it's being extended to the southwest. You see this big empty void where there was no cycle scheme. It literally goes from pretty much here where we are today in Borough, like all the way along to the southeast. There is no cycle scheme. Well, I think it just follows the general trend of transport. You know, we haven't had tubes down in the southeast for, well, we still don't really.
Do you know, I discovered, listeners will be aware of this, but I discovered a few episodes ago why that is, or one of the contributing factors, of completely different soil down here south of the river, much more difficult to put tube lines in. I'm saying you've got unique soil.
Okay. Does that make us special then?
What is the actual reason for the cycle hire scheme eluding you?
I really, really don't know. Like I say, it seems to be a general pattern with transport. The southeast seems to be the last to get everything. I mean, it's actually been great, their extension of the East London line, which comes to Broccoli, is shortly going to be extended to Peckham, etc., which is, I presume we will get the bikes eventually, but it is just, we're always last.
I can see from your body language, by the way, you're quite a smiley person, and during that monologue you started hitting the desk and you look I didn't want to mess with you during that so this really vexes you.
Yeah because it is, why is the southeast of London so cut off? I mean, it is a nightmare, like traveling back on night buses to the part of London where I live in. It's, you know, you don't have as many night buses.
I've got one.
Yeah.
One night bus, that's,
yeah,
it.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Actually just one bus into London.
Yep, exactly the same.
And what I find strange is that the southwest has so many kind of buses out to it. I mean, you can get a bus kind of Brixton, Camberwell, all that area is covered by buses. And southeast doesn't have that as much, certainly not in Greenwich. Although we do get the DLR and that's fun. But it's frustrating to know that actually if the cycle scheme was in southeast London, I could cycle from Greenwich to Peckham. I wouldn't have to get on the one bus that goes between them because I can't get a train between the two. And it feels like not only do we get a little bit disconnected from central London, but the areas around us as well, and the cycle scheme would help with that.
I wonder whether that might be a contributory factor to the sense of community we were talking about earlier on, because each area's slightly more cut off than in other places in London.
That's a really good point. Just like for me trying to get to where you live in Greenwich, it's really, really difficult. You have to like get on, I think, two different buses, which, and then you have to wait for ages at New Cross. And, you know, it would take like, I don't know, half an hour, 20 minutes to cycle from Peckham to Greenwich. Yes, whereas if you were to do it on buses, it would seriously take over an hour.
Yeah. And you're right, that whole sense of community, particularly in Greenwich, because we always feel very cut off because of the river. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think we like it. It's one reason people move to Greenwich. But I remember going to university in Greenwich and not needing to leave either. Mm-hmm. Not needing to go into kind of central London, because everything I needed was on my little bubble of London. So, but yeah, I don't know that people would necessarily use the bicycles to get into central London. And I do wonder if that's a contributing factor to them not being installed as quickly. Mm-hmm. But that's not to say we wouldn't use them to get to other parts of South East London.
So these concerns that people have expressed that they get melted down and sold for scrap because it's south of the river, that's completely unfounded by the sounds of it. No, there was a little twinkle in your eye there, Sharon. It's like, yeah, that's not a bad idea. We should move. Well, we could stay southwest, actually. We've got a story here that takes us to Hampton Court Palace.
Yes, we have. We're talking about an evening discussing the history of sex at Hampton Court Palace. Apparently, the University of Oxford are going to discuss how British attitudes to sex have altered between the 17th and 18th centuries. And apparently, they became more permissive and lots of bedroom conquest from Charles II. And
yeah, I just want to clarify, is this the history of sex at Hampton Court Palace, or is it the history of sex, comma, at Hampton Court Palace?
I think it's just about sex at the palace, I think.
So royal bonking?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, that's it. That seems to be it. Lots of sex at an event that takes place on Thursday, 27th of September.
Well, that's a whole third category you've just opened up there. Just
an orgy.
There is a wine.
To book tickets.
There's a wine reception at the event. Anything could happen. And just a few too many glasses.
I feel like we're doing very efficient publicity for an event that actually isn't anything like
we're telling you that.
I mean, there's another part. I hesitate to introduce this as a partner piece because there's a lovely picture of William and Kate here. I'd like to know why people keep calling her Kate Middleton still. She's not called Kate Middleton anymore, but they do. But this is a Mario Testino, British Royal Portraits at the National Portrait Gallery. I'm not going to draw the connection. And basically, all eyes were on the royals before Team GB, according to the article in this week's Londonist, which of course is where we're getting all of our stories from. And the famous photographer Mario Testino, who I think he's famous for supermodels, isn't he? That's very much his...
Supermodels, not celebrities.
But not just supermodels, he did some very famous pictures of Diana as well.
Yeah.
And that's a really key thing. He does... his Marilyn Monroe portraits were absolutely famous, and I think the portraits that he did of Diana were actually reminiscent of those.
Now, I didn't realise he'd been around that long. He did Marilyn Monroe portraits as well.
Yeah. It's interesting that he should be taking portraits of Kate Middleton after Diana as well.
It is, and it's something that I almost find a little bit uneasy because I feel like a little bit like the British media are trying to push her into the new Diana thing. There's something about that that makes me feel quite uncomfortable. But
On what level? I sort of share the sentiment, but what is it that's making you feel uncomfortable?
Well, there's just something very eerie about putting a photo of the future king's wife next to a picture of her and of his dead mother just because they're wearing a blue dress. That's just comparing someone's wife to their dead mother is actually quite crass in any sense, but given that it could be argued that the media played a large part in her death. Is that legal? Can I say that?
Well, I don't know. Well, there were certainly suggestions, weren't there? I think that what makes me feel creeped out is, if you remember those images early on in Charles and Diana's marriage, and I'm not for a second suggesting there's anything unhappy in the new marriage between William and Kate, But there's something about that chocolate boxy, idolised, just it's as though we've learned nothing in 30 years.
But I honestly believe that that's Mario Testino all over. There's very little else in his portraits. So yes, he can take a gorgeous shot, but that's what you get with those photos. And he's very safe for the royal family. You're never going to get David Bailey doing those. And although I think he did take a photo of the Queen, if I recall, David Bailey did, and it would just be nice to see someone doing something more interesting. They're pretty people.
Well, you've picked a funny week to suggest more interesting pictures of Kate.
No, I think it's interesting what you say about sort of Mario Testino's work. I really think it's all about, you know, celebrity, high glamour, you know, whereas someone like Nan Golding, I don't know whether either of you know her work, which is a lot sort of more brutal and, like, real life people. And you know, I think personally I find those photographs a hell of a lot more interesting than ones taken by Testino, but I wouldn't, you know, he's still a fantastic photographer. But.
So your ideal then would be William dressed in drag, looking like he's had a night out on the smack.
That would be a lot more hilarious. It was kind just, of a
I think Harry might be.
Yeah, exactly.
But just something human. And that, I mean, the palace seemed to flip from one or the other. They want us to kind of really connect with William and Kate, and they really like it when we do that. But then they give us something like this, which we can't relate to, we don't care about, just like, oh, look, very nice photo. And yeah,
it just looks so cheesy though, doesn't it? I mean, this particular, I don't know, was this one by Mario Testino? Yeah. I'm presuming, you know, it looks like, you know, one of those family photographers.
Like OK magazine. And so we're getting married. Here's
we're
our
very
nice
happy,
house.
Darling.
Yeah, it's a bit dull.
There's a photographer's gallery that I walk past on a frequent basis where he seems to specialise in those baby portraits. And he's got this particular style of using light and shadow, almost like a 40s film star portrait, but creepy baby smiles. And I can't quite escape from that idea with this picture. Anyway, that's not a very good advert for Mr. Testino. If you want to make your own judgment, though, don't listen to us. Have a look at the picture here. It's at the British Royal Portraits at the National Portrait Gallery. You can visit npg.org.uk to find out more. That's from October 3rd through 3rd of February, so it's quite a long run there. We have got bags of stuff to talk about here. Do we go for the Greenwich, the big Greenwich one?
Yes.
Because I essentially know that I'm curating a punch-up here, and it's all around the Cutty Sark, as Sian will explain.
Yep, the Cutty Sark has been newly restored, and it's won a Bad Architecture Award. The Carbuncle Cup has actually decided that it's not just one of the worst new pieces of architecture in London, it's the worst new piece of architecture in Britain.
Which is quite right, isn't it, Lara?
From this photo, I haven't seen it in real life, but from this photo, yeah, I would say it looks really quite horrendous. It doesn't look like a boat anymore. It looks like something which has come from outer space. I'm not sure what all this metal kind of web that it seems to be suspended in is all about. I suppose at least you can see underneath the boat, but it's not working for me, but I would have to go and view it in real life.
Well, then we're all in agreement, all three of us,
no,
that this is
not.
It.
Okay, it's absolutely gorgeous. I think they've done a brilliant job. Not only can you see under the boat for the first time ever, you can actually walk around underneath the boat, and that's really key. So, but you can also kind of go on top of it, and it's beautiful. That whole area has been quite a sticking point for people in Greenwich, and not least the restaurants around it. But the centre itself has actually been applauded by people in Greenwich, and I think it looks excellent.
What do you mean about the sticking point? What's been the problem?
Well, you know, you're going to put a massive glass building in an area that we're quite proud of, and the Greenwich residents certainly would devastated when the fire happened on the Cutty Sark. I mean, it was heartbreaking. And yeah, we wanted to see something really good come out of it. And then it was delayed and all stuff like this. We've been waiting for this for a long time. And I think they've done a brilliant job. And for every person who hates it, there will be more people who love it and think it looks gorgeous. And I'm one of the people who thinks it looks gorgeous.
Well, so that's a very passionate response, I must say. How do we explain this award?
It's an easy target. It's I think it's very easy to say, look at it, it's grotesque, it's ugly, you can't see the bottom of the boat anymore, etc. But the Cutty Sark is a big boat. You can see the rest of it. It's not like they hide the entire thing in a museum. The bit that would be under the water is a very small part. They've turned that into a museum, part of the museum in itself. And that's a really clever thing to have done, because that was just something that was in a stone pit before. And the building itself, I'm not necessarily a fan of shiny, sparkly glass architecture, but to make that work alongside a really old boat is impressive. The curves of the glass work with the curves of the boat, shiny.
And it connects up, doesn't it, with those other buildings with a similar sort of roof structure. I can't help being reminded of the British Museum when I look at this. It seems to be a sort of a thematic connection between these historical sites. I'm surprised, actually, that the Shard didn't get a look in. But I suppose it's not finished yet, is it? They're still missing that bit off the top. It's probably why. It sounds as though quite a strong defence has been put up there. Are you buying any of that, Lara?
I think it... I would need to see it in real life.
So it could be the photographer's fault here, taking the picture like this.
It could possibly be the photographer's fault, because I presume you've actually seen it in real life.
Yeah.
I think it's really difficult to judge a three-dimensional huge piece by a very small photograph. But as it looks in that photo, you know, I don't know, I just can't see that it's working. I don't like that sort of steel structure with the boat. I don't know.
What about other English heritage listings that have happened in the last little while? I know that they brought out their list fairly recently of protected sites that have been upgraded or protected in other ways.
Yeah, apparently there's been 100 new sites across 23 London boroughs, including the Lloyd's Building, 19 tube stations, the Strand Union Workhouse, and I think wasn't there some the telephone boxes as well?
By Jove, I think you're right. Yes, red the traditional red
K6.
Yeah, that's exactly right. K6 telephone boxes. If you want to know what a K6 telephone box looks like, just think of a phone box.
But the thing which is, it says it's three K6 telephone boxes in Bloomsbury. I don't know why it's those three in particular.
No, perhaps some important calls were made there by somebody. No, it's very peculiar. Does that mean that most other K6 phone boxes are not protected? We need to dig a little deeper on this story.
I wonder if the K6 ones, the very particularly tall ones.
Well, we've looked up K6 telephone boxes, and they're the red traditional telephone boxes. They're not that tall, because I whack my head on the door return every time I go in one.
But there are a few that are kind of significantly taller than the others.
You're not thinking of the Shard again, are you?
No, I'm not thinking of the Shard. But there are telephone boxes that are significantly taller, so they can be seen.
Is this true?
Yes, this is true. I'm not just making it up.
I've never seen one like that. Where are they?
I can't remember, and now you're not going to believe me. I don't remember, but there are a few that are just significantly taller because of the area they're in. Crystal Palace, I think, has one.
With only one? So these are very rare, then?
I don't know.
Okay, there's a look of panic
I've
on
there. I've seen one, and now I feel like I'm getting into a massive kind of tumble that I'm not entirely sure.
Let's enlist the help of the listener. If you know what Sian Meads is talking about, please can you contact us? We need to know about tall telephone boxes. We've got no evidence for them so far. You may be able to supply.
I'm Googling.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Sian is Googling in the background. We're going to have a revelation. We're going to be doing a very boring Boris Johnson story in just a moment. She's going to go, yes, Crystal Palace. Do you want to... Let's do a poll of our two guests here, one of whom is Googling. She's found the phone boxes. Okay, the show's gone to pieces because of a personal quest. Sian, you look like you've found something.
I think I have. But not just yet, sorry.
This isn't making good radio. Listen to Sian Google. Can I coax you off your phone?
Let's move on, and then I will go back to it, if that's okay, just because I think...
You've picked up the phone again. You're an obsessive, aren't you?
Yes, I am, yes.
Are you like that? Do you get a bee in your bonnet, and then you've got to go for it?
I need to know facts. There's something just really... I hate not... not finding out the answer to something and just kind of just now having no idea what K6 phone box is. And I'm just like, well, I should know that. So there are listeners listening and shouting, and it's just like, well, it's this, you silly woman. And so I have to find out what it is.
A definite candidate for the quiz later on. Please do tell us about this K6 phone. If you have spotted an unusually tall phone box and it wasn't hallucinatory, please can you tell us and help this poor woman out of her mental torment. Boris Johnson, who has a regular slot on this show, it would seem, has put himself in charge of the Olympic legacy. That's one of the stories this week. But there's also news on how you can watch Mayor's Question Time if you've a yen to go and see Boris responding to questions. And, of course, they come around with regularity. I want to sort of get a straw poll from the two of you. Have you the faintest interest in seeing the Mayor answer questions from the public and the press?
Not particularly. I wouldn't, like... I wouldn't take time out of my day to listen or watch it, but you know, I think it's an interesting thing to do, and I think he should be questioned by the public and the press.
This has the potential to be a very, very dull story if you're not into. And what I often wonder about is people say, "Oh, I'm not really into politics," and yet the sort of stuff that's being discussed here, for example, in the last one, there was a discussion over 200,000 jobs being created in London, extending the DLR to Bromley, very much the sort of thing we've been talking about in today's recording. Police numbers being maintained or cut back, so to do with our safety, fire engine. You know, this is very important stuff. It's very much along the lines that we've been discussing. Now, what is it that's failing to grasp our imagination when it comes to Mayor's Question Time, which is sort of the forum for this stuff getting decided upon, getting done, and the public interacting with our beloved leader?
I think, to be honest, it's the politicians themselves. I think they're, you know, they are just quite dull. They're not that interesting to listen to. I think Boris, of all of them, is the most interesting. I'm sure I read on the site this morning that he's just won another poll of being London's favourite or Britain's favourite politician.
It's said that he's the most popular, but I don't necessarily think he's popular for the right reasons.
Exactly.
He's popular because he gets stuck in a zip wire. Yeah. And
you can't imagine Harold Macmillan doing that, can you?
I am now. I think it's important, and I wish I'd engaged more with stuff like that, especially when it comes to the campaign of Boris, keep your promise and things like that, because I think mayors make a lot of promises and they say they're going to do a lot of stuff and then they don't. And Boris is good at that. And I believe that he will hide behind the success of the Olympics and go on to win another election.
He seems to be trying to take charge of stuff as well. I mentioned he's taken over the Olympic legacy work. Yeah, well, because he's presumably he would have handed that over to somebody else if it hadn't gone as well as he wanted.
Absolutely. He would have blamed it all on Ken Livingstone.
Yes, that's always an option. It was the last lot what done it. Last week, the mayor announced an inquiry to rival the government's own aviation inquiry. Competition there again, potentially for number 10, except that the one at City Hall will only consider alternatives to Heathrow. Alternatives to, not expansion of. And of course, there's a good relationship with number 10 is what Boris promised us. And he seems to really be baiting David Cameron, doesn't it? Does that mean that we run the risk of getting less help from number 10 as a city rather than more?
I think London will always be a priority. And I know this is a Londonist podcast, but I worry about that in itself. We do a very good job sometimes of separating ourselves from the rest of the country. And I think it's not that we should annoy number 10, but I think perhaps looking at ways to be more inclusive and kind of partner with some really amazing cities in the rest of the England and the UK. Londoners are very London-centric. That's why we have Londonist podcasts and think the city is amazing, but I think we forget that there are other cities.
Okay, how do I approach this story? This is about Westminster Council, and Westminster Council has invoked the new powers that they have been given over squatters. I've got a bit of a problem with Westminster Council's approach to all sorts of things. The fairly hardcore approach to parking seems OTT. We've talked on the show in previous episodes about their attitude towards the homeless. We had talk of soup runs being banned. prior to the Olympics to discourage homeless people from, well, from existing, essentially, but certainly within the borough of Westminster. There was the making it illegal to lie down on the street in Westminster as well, which was being discussed. And now we've got the power over squatters. So yet again, it's this time a successful attempt to criminalise homelessness. Now, I think that squatting has several different facets to it, doesn't it? We've got the aspect which is people who are earning money and for various reasons, perhaps aesthetic, perhaps because they just feel like they don't want to buy a property or spend money on rent. They'll move into a disused place and take it over. Some would argue that they do it good. Some clearly don't do it good. Then you've got long-term homeless people who can't get on the council list in any way, who feel the need to squat. You've got other people who sort of officially don't exist within the country, who've got no alternative but to squat. So this isn't a cut and dry issue. And what's happened, new council powers have come about because of the image of the householder returning home from holiday and finding somebody has set up home in their home. And the idea of this law being brought in, these powers being brought in, was so that the householder could evict these tenants and they wouldn't have to break the law themselves by breaking down their own front door. All of so my heart was in this story. I believed, yeah, this is a good law to bring in. And here we have Westminster Council introducing this law where their own properties are concerned and criminalising the people who are squatting within those premises. It's a complex one. It's a thorny one. What do you make of the Westminster Council's approach to this issue, Sian Meads?
I think you're right, it is thorny, and it sounds actually like the law was put in place with good intentions, but it's if it's not used in the right way, and it does seem to be that that's the case. There's little empathy for homeless people, I think, from the government and from people in Parliament. And that's actually, it's a major issue with London. And I think, I wonder if over the last few weeks with the Olympics, we've glossed over it. We've made ourselves look like a great city to the rest of the world. But we're still a city with problems. Like, we can talk about the riots and all the great stuff that's coming out of that. But that's very much reacting to a situation. And we do that. We're great at reacting to the riots or reacting to the bombings, and we really pull together. Yet when it comes to homeless people that are there every single day, we shy away from it because it's not an issue that affects our everyday lives. And I think Westminster and kind of the government still brush that under the carpet. And I think Boris still brushes that under the carpet as well. I think that's the bigger issue.
I think I'm understanding something about our national character here, because we certainly like to moan about stuff, don't we? And then we're very proud of ourselves when we have a crisis of some description and we stop moaning briefly. That's essentially it, isn't it? We've switched the moaning off for a few days.
I actually work for a homeless charity, SHP, doing sort of creative art projects. So I work with a diverse kind of range of people who have ended up in the charity through homelessness. And I don't know, it is a massive issue. And people end up homeless for many different reasons, you know, for alcohol, addiction reasons, I don't know, for mental health reasons, for, you know, loss of job, loss of earnings.
Loss of relationships, quite often.
Loss of relationships, yeah, exactly. And all these things lead them, you know, to be in a really, really dreadful place. And I think then to actually be penalised and possibly, it says here, actually be put in jail for 6 months and possibly signed £5,000. It just seems, I don't know, it seems a very harsh and very narrow-sighted way of treating people who are incredibly vulnerable.
There's also the arguments that say finding someone who's homeless £5,000 isn't going to help the situation. No, if you have no money. And also, I worry that actually jail might be preferable to someone being on the streets, and that's a terrifying prospect. It's an issue that isn't going to be solved with a very simplistic law.
No, this one-law-fits-all approach is extremely dangerous, isn't it? There's no getting around it. This is bad news, and it almost presupposes that anybody who is squatting doesn't really need to squat. this fine, for example, seems to give away an overall view that they've got the money really and they should just behave properly rather than waste it. But these are people quite very often, and it may only be for one night, two nights, something like that. I've got to say, my experience having gone around with the spot team not far from here and had a look at night time at how people are coping with homelessness, well, you start out not knowing what you're doing, and if you're going to get caught squatting by being noticed going into a building or something like that because you haven't got the experience to keep it quiet, well, you're going to be the person who's picked up and fined and put in prison. So inadvertently, perhaps this even targets the people who are less experienced, you know, the people who really, you know, one or two nights out.
Fining people who are basically trying to stay alive, and that's a really callous thing to do.
So what's the answer to this then? Is it a more nuanced law?
I don't think it's a simple answer. I think the trouble is there are loads and loads of empty properties in London and all our cities. I know some of them are unsafe, but surely some of them money can be put into actually making them safe places for people to go. You know, I've no idea how that kind of thing would be funded, but we have got lots of empty space. We've got lots of homeless people. Surely those two could be put together and work as a positive rather than as a negative.
I wonder about the... We had a recent change in planning law, didn't we, from the government, and they have allowed us as homeowners now to extend our property a little bit more than we did before. And it's part of this conservative, I think, led thrust to reduce the planning restrictions that surround development and so forth, with an eye to improving the housing situation somewhat. Well, what about if it were made possible or made easier for us to engage a bit of that community spirit that we've been talking about throughout this show in various ways, and have some of the post-riot clean-up spirit get us out there with our mops and brooms and maybe some building implements as well, and fix up some properties and make them usable?
I would love to think that would happen and it would be a great idea, but we react to events rather than an everyday thing. There are charities who work on this sort of thing every single day, and yet we walk past sometimes 10, 15 homeless people in an afternoon, and, you know, we don't react anymore, which is a terribly sad thing. But I think what Westminster needs to do is stop putting the blame on homeless people.
I think that's an excellent last word on that story. Okay, I've got to find a way to lift the mood here from talking about very serious things.
We're doing next week
an excellent event.
Yes,
right. Yes, it's an excellent event. We are teaming up with the Prince Charles Cinema in Leicester Square, and we are screening The Neverending Story. They haven't screened it for a very long time. I think certainly over 5 years. And it's absolutely one of our favourite films. It's on Tuesday. Screening starts at 8:30. We're starting with a short film from a female filmmaker in the UK who we haven't chosen yet. We did a competition and we haven't chosen a winner yet. But
Crikey, this is a bit last minute then.
Well, we've got the films. It's fine. It's all good. But the tickets are selling really quickly. They're £10.
And they can be found on what website?
You can find them on the Prince Charles Cinema. There is also a link on domesticslottery.com. And you may even be able to buy some on the night. And we might be giving some away today.
Along the same lines of that, I'd like to say about the Free Peckham and Nunhead Film Festival, which has been happening until Sunday. I think it was mentioned in the Londonist last week. It's completely free. You can go along, see films. There's all over Peckham and Nunhead. I think there's also something running at the cinema on Sunday, which is where my quilt will be.
At the Peckham Multiplex?
Yeah.
And how do people find out how to get there? Is there a website?
Yeah, I can't remember the exact, but if you put in to Google Peckham Nunhead Free Film Festival, you'll find all the details of venues and the films that are showing.
I like that very Peckham approach to it. Yeah, don't worry about the exact website, just, you know, you'll find us. Come to the right bit of town and ask for me. Someone will tell you. Yeah, don't worry about it. A few other things going on in the week ahead for you. Well, dance company Zoo Nation returned to the West End this week with its acclaimed production Some Like It Hip Hop, a mashup of Billy Wilder's much-loved film and Shakespeare's Twelfth Night. Some Like It Hip Hop is set in a city where books are banned and women are subservient. Directed by Kate Prince, this heartwarming family production features Zoo Nation's trademark style of hip-hop, comedy and physical theatre, with original music by Josh Cohen and DJ Wald. Tickets range from £12 to £38, and the show runs from Tuesday, the 25th of September, until the 13th of October. Visit saddlerswells.com to find out more. Our art recommendation this week is at the Whitechapel Gallery, part of the Whitechapel's programme of showing rarely seen private collections. This is the first of four displays from the collection Sandretto di Robedengo. Italian artist Maurizio Cattelan is known as an agent provocateur, using stunts to address universal themes of dogma, power and death. This solo display includes one of his earliest works, oh yes, a miniature family kitchen featuring a squirrel that has committed suicide. Called Biddy Biddy Biddo Biddy Boo, after the fairy godmother's song in Disney's Cinderella, this work encapsulates Catalan's acerbic wit and his melancholic worldview. The exhibition is free and it runs from Tuesday the 25th of September until December. Go to whitechapelgallery.org to find out more. There's a star-studded theatre show opening at the Harold Pinter Theatre this week. A Chorus of Disapproval features Rob Brydon, Nigel Harmon and Ashley Jensen on stage and Trevor Nunn in the director's chair. Written by Alan Akeborn, A Chorus of Disapproval tells the story of shy young widower Guy, who joins a production of the Beggar's Opera that is rapidly going off the rails. Guy soon gets more than he bargained for as he discovers that all the best action happens off stage. Opening on Thursday the 27th of September and running until January, tickets for A Chorus of Disapproval cost between £10 and £53. Visit achorusofdisapproval.com. Now, if you love world music, here's a heads up about an exciting festival taking place at the South Bank Centre this week. Darbar is the UK's premier classical Indian music festival, and it returns to the South Bank Centre from Thursday for its annual mix of sublime vocals and punchy instrumentalists. Drawing from both Hindustani and Carnatic traditions, the festival gives you the chance to hear the very best maestros and up-and-coming artists from the UK and the Indian subcontinent. The Darbar Festival runs from Thursday the 27th until Sunday the 30th of September. Visit darbar.org to find out more. And finally, a new one-room exhibition at the British Museum has caught our eye this week, called Ritual and Revelry, The Art of Drinking in Asia. The show examines the importance of alcohol, tea, and of course water in Asian culture over the past 2,500 years. The exhibition celebrates the ritual and social uses of liquids, including sake, toddy, water, and the mightiest Asian drink that has conquered the world, tea. A free exhibition, Ritual and Revelry, opens on Thursday the 27th of September and runs until the 6th of January. Visit britishmuseum.org. And don't forget, you can find out more about all of the events just listed and many more, as well as all the stories we've been discussing in today's show, at londonist.com. Well, the weekly quiz is hoving into view, much to the pleasure of my two guests this week, Sian Mead and Lara Haley. It's just time to let you know that at Londonist, we would love to give you free food, and we'd love you to go to riverford.co.uk/Londonist to claim it. You will find there, waiting for you, a half-price vegetable box. Yes, fresh seasonal organic veg, fruit and meat delivered to you for half price, thanks to Riverford and Londonist. Sian Mead, Lara Haley, are you strapped in and ready for this week's historical quiz?
Goodness.
Yes.
I'm getting competitive already.
Okay, so 5 points available and the honour of you and your project at stake. Monday, the 17th of September, 1961. Police arrest 1,314 demonstrators at a CND, that's Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, protest in Trafalgar Square. Which noted philosopher is amongst those arrested?
I actually read this story this morning and I've forgotten the answer.
I don't know.
Not overly successful between the two of you then. There are guesses about it. It's a noted philosopher who was alive in 1961. Lots of gesturing, good. Shaking of heads, but Still silence. Go on. Yes, there was nearly a word there.
There was. Can't we have some clues?
The question one moves into its second hour.
Yeah, you
can I do an impression of him? I've never seen the man talk. He speaks with a very effete, well-educated sort of
French,
but no, he's English.
That was an English.
Not a very good impression. a very clipped sort of side-parted kind of a fellow. Highly English, very English name. Same name as a famous P.G. Woodhouse character. Do you know every listener to this show is going to be going, it's Bertrand Russell.
Yeah.
Oh, is it Bertrand Russell?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Terrible. 18th of September, 1970. Who is found dead in his basement flat in Notting Hill, West London?
Jimi Hendrix.
It was Jimi Hendrix, yes. Guitar legend Jimi Hendrix. Subsequent inquest records an open verdict on his death, noting that he drank wine and took 9 sleeping pills on the previous night. I would have drawn conclusions from that myself, but there we go. Wednesday, the 19th of September, but in which year? 6 people die as a high-speed intercity 125 train collides with a freight train in Southall, North London. An inquiry would find that the driver missed 2 warning signals and that the train's 2 safety systems could have averted the accident. They were inoperative. What year did the Southall rail crash happen? And I'll give it to you within 2 years.
1990?
No. 93. No, you need to go higher. I'll give you one more guess.
96.
It's 97, so Sian, yeah, you get your second point. Thursday, the 20th of September, 2000. What is fired? I need you to be very precise here. What is fired at the MI6 headquarters at Vauxhall Cross, causing minor damage to the 8th floor?
What was the date?
This is 2000. I don't even remember this happening, but apparently it did.
Oh, it could be anything.
It could. Let's have a few guesses.
Is it a starter pistol?
It was not a starter pistol.
Oh,
we're after the projectile.
Oh.
Very specific sort of projectile.
So party poppers can't be my next answer. Catapult.
Not a catapult. Think slightly more dangerous, for goodness sake.
A cannon.
Good guess. This is turning into quite a comic strip in my mind, to be honest.
A shot put.
Not a shot put. What a delightful answer.
This is a fun evening.
Do you know what? I'm just going to let this question run. We could just use this as the show. Look, we need to get dangerous, and I'll give you one guess each. Yes, closest one is going to win this point.
More dangerous than a cannon?
Yeah, that was quite dangerous, wasn't it?
Yeah, like a bazooka.
Yeah, that's not bad going. Do you want to refine it?
I was thinking machine gun, but I don't know.
It was an
AK-47.
It was an anti-tank missile.
Our answers were better.
Yeah. Your answers were way better, yeah, absolutely. The real IRA, who didn't think of any of those modes of attack, is blamed for the attack. Finally, so I suppose I've got to give that to you. You said bazooka, that's pretty close.
I also said party popper.
You're right, you've talked yourself out of that point. Friday, the 21st of September 1969, more than 200 policemen storm a mansion in Piccadilly, central London, but why? 21st of September 1969.
A legal party?
You're on the right track.
Was it squatters?
It was squatters.
Yeah.
It was and all the work done for you. Yeah, that was very good. That's 3 to Sian and 2. Oh, that's the lowest scoring quiz we have ever had. Well, there we go. Sian Mead, you are the champion of this week's quiz. Lara Haley, you go home in shame. And yes, try and work out what happened. Thank you both for joining us. A quick reminder of websites or contact it, just a bite-sized smidgen to leave us with.
My quilt, which is post-it notes from Peckham Peace Wall, will be on display in Peckham Cinema, which is on Rye Lane.
Yes, and the lifestyle blog for women who have better things to do is domesticsluttery.com. You can also follow us on Twitter as Domestic Sluts.
Lara Haley and Sian Meads, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to my interviewees, Sian Meads and Lara Haley. Thanks too to Bernie Barkley, Zoe Craig and Dave Haste. Theme and incidental music was by Jack Hurd and Rory Anderson. And I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.